You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
America's always been touted as the land of opportunity, but according to Barry C. Lynn, the consolidation of power in nearly every sector suffocates competition, dominates the economy, and puts the public at risk. His latest book, Cornered, looks into those largely camouflaged monopolies and their economic and political power. It's published by John Wiley & Sons, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Barry C. Lynn to our show today. Hello.
How are you doing?
Consumers often feel overwhelmed by choice. The shelves are stocked with products. There seems to be endless versions of cereal, soups, and computer games. Haven't we been given a real variety of choices over the last few affluent decades?
Well, it seems that way, but it's really kind of an illusion of choice. And when you go to a lot of stores nowadays, you see these shelves say, you know, it could be 20 or 30 different toothpaste varieties, and they're really brought to you by two different companies. And those two different companies actually collude in many ways. They work together to figure out where each toothpaste tube is going to be and what pricing is going to be put on that. And so it's not the free market system that we are told it actually is.
And when certain competitors come along, like Tom's of Maine, they wind up being gobbled up by the big ones?
Well, exactly. I mean, Tom's of Maine is really Tom's of Colgate nowadays. And, you know, Tom's, when they first brought it out, the idea was to beat these big guys. And at a certain point, they said they can't. They realized that it was no longer possible to beat these guys, and they kind of gave up.
But does that make for a lousier product? Isn't Tom's of Maine still Tom's of Maine? Isn't Ben and Jerry's still the same Ben and Jerry's?
It could be. I mean, it's like the issue is the quality of the products may be kept up. We actually don't know how well they're being kept up. But the question is, you know, is there real competition that is leading people to deliver you the best product possible at the lowest price? And that's actually not the case.
You spent a lot of time at malls with your mother when you were growing up. Was she a serious shopper?
Yeah, she was a pretty serious shopper. You know, that was back when you had lots of different stores and you had lots of different brands. And, you know, this is back in the 70s and 80s. And it's a pretty different world right now when you go into malls or department stores.
What did you discover at the Fashion Place Mall in Salt Lake City when you were comparison shopping for sunglasses?
Well, I was out there. I'd heard a little bit about some problems in the eyeglass industry. And what I found out is in this one mall where there was actually about two or three different companies selling glasses, they're all owned by one company, an Italian company called Luxottica.
I've never heard of Luxottica.
They don't brand. I mean, they actually hide behind – they have these retailers. If you go to Lens Crafters, if you go to Pearle Vision, or if you go to Target Optical, or you go to Sears Optical, you're basically going to Luxottica. And then the thing is that also if you go to many of these independent boutiques and you get a Donna Karan glasses or you get a pair of Tag Heuer glasses, you're actually buying Luxottica products as well.
And since they're an Italian company, does this apply outside the United States as well?
They probably have more of a hold over the U.S. market than they do over the European market. They have more of a hold over the U.S. market than over the Chinese market. Our laws in this country have, if anything, not merely allowed but promoted monopolization more than any other major market in the world in recent years.
Does a company like Luxottica thrive because they can keep their prices really low?
Pricing is – they will use pricing when they are targeting a competitor. And then once they have taken that competitor down, prices will tend to go up.
That's something that we've seen in a lot of different areas. We'll get into beer later, but isn't that what Anheuser-Busch did to change the beer industry at one point?
That's exactly what they've done. I mean, it's what Walmart does. Walmart sort of targets competitors with lower prices. But then once they control a marketplace, prices tend to go up.
You say that you were putting together material for this book a decade before the meltdown of 2008. So you saw all of the potential failures back then, or were you surprised by what happened?
Well, I started on this because I came to this because there's a some years back, I saw a sort of flaw in the global production system. And I used to run a magazine called Global Business. And we wrote for the people who are actually running the large global corporations. And I was watching how they're reorganizing their supply systems. And what I was saying is that there is a massive amount of concentration of certain production activities so that you could end up having industrial crashes. And this means that you lose access to like a certain type of semiconductor, all the production of which is all concentrated in one place, say Taiwan. And then you have a really big problem because that semiconductor goes into all these other products. And if you lose access to it, which actually happened, there was an earthquake, and then you have this crash, which is an entirely new phenomena in human history, industrial crash. So that's actually what led me to start to look at concentration in our economy, both in the consumer sector and in the industrial sector and in all these other areas.
Now, you said that the reason a company like Luxottica can thrive in the United States even more than other places is because of our laws. And I'm assuming most people would think, well, then the changes began during the Reagan era, but didn't they begin actually before that?
There was some changes that actually go back to 1975. This is when Ford was president and when there was a Democratic majority in Congress. They began to change the laws that protected the power of the producer to price its own product. And there was, we can argue about that, but the major change, the radical change took place in 1981 when Reagan took power. And at that point, what they did is they took our anti-monopoly laws, which were perhaps our most important laws that we use to prevent the consolidation of political power in this country, and they essentially overthrew those laws.
The president said, President Reagan, that he planned to pursue an antitrust policy based on efficiency. So it was he was thinking about how it would help the business community rather than help the consumer as far as he saw it.
I'm not sure what Reagan actually was thinking at that time. I do have a pretty good sense about what the people who put this plan together were thinking, and that was Robert Bork, the justice, and then there was also Alan Greenspan was part of this crew, and then the sort of head of that was Milton Friedman. And when those guys promoted the idea of efficiency in the application of our antitrust anti-monopoly law, what they were advocating was the same line of argument that J.P. Morgan had made when he essentially controlled all of Wall Street, or John D. Rockefeller was promoting when he controlled all of the oil production in this country.
They were talking about the inviolability of the free market system. But as you say, that's something that we had. People were talking about at the end of the 19th century. What's the difference between that and the more recent developments?
Well, what's happened, I mean, there's in our country, you could kind of look at it, we have had two periods of democratic, in which we were really a democratic republic. And that means that where you actually distribute power out to the individual citizen as much as possible. And that was in the period leading up to the Civil War. Certainly, if you exclude the plantation economies. And then after the Civil War, you saw this massive consolidation of power in the hands of the plutocrats. And then the government got into the business of running this system under Teddy Roosevelt. And then you had this radical revolution, which took place in the Second New Deal, 1935, when the sort of populists, who were actually the Jeffersonians, the Madisonians, they sort of got back into power. And they redistributed power out to communities, to citizens all across the country. And so when, at least when I was growing up, we lived in a world in which anyone could really start a business. Anyone could go out and be a farmer. Anyone could go out and be a plumber. There weren't hardly any chains in mid-century America. And it was that opportunity, that land of opportunity of going out and being able to pursue the American dream, that's what was overthrown.
But it was, you say, it was overthrown mostly during the Reagan years, but the Democrats controlled Congress, didn't they? Why did they go along with it?
At that point, and there was a, you could actually say there was a sort of a flaw. This is actually, it's a great question, and it's What you saw in the debates in 1981 over what should we do with our anti-monopoly laws, there you saw an argument between a bipartisan group that was saying we need to protect them as is. We need to use them to protect ourselves against concentrated power, political power. And then you had a bipartisan group that was promoting their overthrow. And the group you had essentially, that bipartisan group was the Milton Friedman, the Chicago School group, in alliance with certain people on the left side of the political system, like this would John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, and some of his disciples. Those guys really didn't believe in antitrust, and they were actually overt socialists. I mean, John Kenneth Galbraith, by that point, said we just need to, run these systems from the top down. So essentially you had this alliance of left socialists with right free marketeers and so-called free marketeers, and they were the ones that were promoting the overthrow of antitrust.
My guest is Barry C. Lynn, director of the Markets, Enterprise, and Resiliency Initiative at the New America Foundation. He's written a book called Cornered, The New Monopoly, Capitalism, and the Economics of Destruction. It is published by Wiley. Let's look back at some of the major changes we've seen over the years. For example, how was the AMP company prevented from growing at a certain point when it looked like it was pretty much going to dominate the supermarket field?
I mean, it's a sort of a lost history in our country. It's an important history because, there's sometimes people say, oh, we shouldn't go too radical with our antitrust enforcement because we'll be breaking up these large industrial firms that are very important. We'll be trying to take apart DuPont, and we don't really want to do that. We'll be trying to take apart Boeing, and we need that concentrated power. But what people forget is that for a long time we used our anti-monopoly laws also to protect the independent grocer, the independent restaurateur, the independent tool and die shop from the capture. They're captured by people who were armed with capital and chain stores, the chain store model. So AMP was one of the first chains that people were using to try and roll up control over a certain type of retail, the retail of groceries. And we had these laws that were passed in the 1930s that were aimed precisely to prevent the use of chains to take over all of these independent grocers.
Now, were those laws not in place when Walmart and Target started expanding?
Actually, when Walmart and Target, way back in the 50s, when Sam Walton started his business, he was taking advantage of the fact that the antitrust enforcers at that point were preventing the Kreskes and the Woolworths, the old chains that had started in the 20s. They were preventing those companies from putting all the little guys out of business. He was able to start his business because of the antitrust enforcers. But then what happened is the Walmart grew to immense scale after 1981, after the elimination of antitrust. Before 1981, Walmart simply would have not been allowed to ever become nearly this big.
Well, one of the concerns about the development of monopolies is that after they gain control, they drive up prices. But hasn't Walmart pretty much kept prices down?
Walmart keeps certain prices down in markets where it's competing closely with a company like Target. Once Walmart drives its competitors out, prices tend to go up. The other thing that Walmart does is it doesn't actually deliver competitive. It forces all of these suppliers that are under its power to conglomerate. If you go to Walmart now and you go back into the milk case and you're going to buy milk for your children, you may see four or five different brands of milk back there. You might see like Pet Dairy. You might see Mayfield Dairy. You see Great Value. It's the in-store brand. You see Horizon. That's the organic. All of these brands are coming to you from one company, Dean Foods. So it's like, what? Even when you go to Walmart and you think you're getting delivered lower prices, you're actually being presented with these monopolies which Walmart helped to create.
My guest is Barry C. Lynn. His book, Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction, published by Wiley. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Barry C. Lynn. His book, Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction, published by Wiley. I don't know how big a conglomerate Wiley is part of, but that's in the media we have seen something close to monopoly creation with conglomeratization. I'm thinking about what happened, for example, with NBC. In 1930, General Electric was compelled to, by antitrust charges, to divest themselves of RCA, which owned NBC. Then in 1986, they bought NBC back. In 1943, NBC was forced to break up, leading to the creation of the ABC network. You can't imagine that happening now, where someone like Rupert Murdoch can own more than one radio, TV station in a market, and more than one newspaper.
Well, I would like to imagine that happening again. And I actually think that that's a huge issue that we need to be talking about now in this country, which is the domination, the control over the media. You know, and we have to understand this was something that you mentioned, something that happened in 86. That was under Ronald Reagan, but it was Bill Clinton, his team, sort of cleared the way for a lot of the consolidation that we've seen in media. So this is not something where the Democrats are better than the Republicans, or certainly not in recent years. But this is a huge issue. We see this in books nowadays. I mean, Amazon's control over the book publishers in this country is scary. Their ability to manipulate these guys is scary.
But it wasn't all that long ago that they were complaining that Barnes & Noble had too much control. Now Barnes & Noble is in serious trouble. So don't business cycles change this anyway?
What we've seen is since 1980, like say just in books, for instance, is the rise, the every sort of 5 or 8 years or so, of a new and better model that consolidates more power, and then that one kind of dies off. But we now see with Amazon, they control, like when it comes to ebooks, 85-90% of the ebooks. I mean, that's real control.
You say that the modern era of beer in the United States began on October 14th, 1978. Why that specific day?
Well, that was when the Congress of the United States, or actually Jimmy Carter, signed a bill that had been passed to allow people to brew beer in their own homes. You could brew up to 100 gallons of beer. This was something that had been – they thought that they were going to put it into the bill that overturned prohibition. They left it out. So finally they returned the power to brew beer in your own house to the American people. And that was when all of these guys and women who figured out how to brew all of this marvelous beer, which we drink today, that's when they figured out how to do it. They had been made free to go out and make the old-style beers.
And so we wound up with a lot of microbreweries and brew pubs. On the other hand, New York used to be the home of breweries, including Schaefer, Rheingold, Peel's, Rupert, Ballantine. They're all gone.
Yeah, you know, in 1978, when that law was passed, there were 42 large breweries in the United States, 42. Now there's 1,540. The difference is that those 42, they split up the market. The biggest one was Anheuser-Busch, which had about 20% in 1978 of the total market. Nowadays, the 1,535 of our breweries share 4% of the marketplace. Two brewing companies, or rather two foreign trading companies, Anheuser-Busch InBev and South African Breweries, which owns Miller Coors, and these two giant trading companies openly collude, both in the United States and outside the United States. These two control 90%+ of the beer sold in the United States.
So they're controlling the stuff that we see on the shelves of the supermarket, although a few supermarkets may sell the more specialized beers as well.
And actually, it would be more if I'd be more honest if I said they pretty much control all beer, because the little guys, and I've spoken to many little guys. I spoke at the convention of the little guys back in April, the little beer brewers. These guys, if they want to get their beer onto the shelves of a large store, they don't call up the buyer at Walmart. They don't call up the buyer at Costco. They call up the guy at Anheuser-Busch, and they beg their direct competitor for permission to put their beer on those trucks and put it onto their shelves in the big stores.
Is that true for any new product getting on the shelves of a big chain of stores?
There's very few new products that, you know, packaged products that get onto the shelves. I mean, if you remember Vitamin Water, the guy who created Vitamin Water actually had to create his own shelving system, which he stuck at the front of stores because the shelving system in the back of the stores was essentially owned by the big companies. And now he's owned by Coca-Cola. So it's almost impossible, unless you have like a certain kind of newfangled food, which a Whole Foods might be interested in, it's almost impossible to get a new product on the store shelves in the United States today.
Procter & Gamble controls so many of those shelves, and I'm stunned sometimes when I see just how many different products they sell. But nobody's calling them a monopoly.
I mean, they're not, you know, it depends how you interpret the word monopoly. It's like they don't have 100% control. But actually, this is something where I like Milton Friedman's interpretation. If you have sufficient power to determine the terms at which deals are done within a marketplace, you're a monopoly. So by that definition, Procter & Gamble is a monopolist company, absolutely.
On the other hand, can't Walmart tell Procter & Gamble what ingredients it wants to see in certain things?
We actually have it's kind of the worst of all worlds, because we have a situation with this hierarchy of monopolies. And Walmart, it now sells, and this is a really shocking figure, it sells 30% of many products in this country, 40% of certain kinds of products, even 50%, like pet food in this country, more than 50% of the pet food in this country is sold by Walmart. So this one company, if you are a producer, even if you're an incredibly powerful producer, to get to your customers, you have to go across this company, Walmart. You have to go across their floors. So that landlord owns essentially the entire political economy that is designed to supply consumers in the United States with our products. It's a concentration of power we have never, ever seen in this country, in the political economy, even back in the days of J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller.
My guest is Barry C. Lynn, Director of the Markets, Enterprise, and Resiliency Initiative at the New America Foundation. His articles have appeared in publications that include Harper's, the Financial Times, Harvard Business Review, the National Interest. He has written a new book called Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction. It is published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So I'm curious about how the concept of always lower prices serves as a weapon in the war to control economic activity.
Well, always lower prices, it's a way to, like with Walmart, I don't want to always go back, but they're such a good example.
Well, they do dominate, maybe not in New York, but they do dominate retail store business throughout this country, don't they?
Absolutely.
Every town has a Walmart, even New York.
They're essentially the central authoritarian figure. I mean, they really are kind of almost like a Soviet-style system that's grown up right in the middle of the American political economy.
You say Soviet style because it's so top down?
It's so top down. They do basically, I mean, I talk to a lot of these suppliers, you know, the guys from boxing companies, from P&G, from Kraft Foods. These are giant, powerful firms, but when they go to Bentonville, they kowtow. They get down on their knees. They do whatever Walmart wants them to do. And a lot of what Walmart does is very irrational. And they also say, it's like they always say, it's a very efficient firm. It's actually terribly inefficient. If you talk to anyone who knows you know, it's like when they put products into these into the back room of Walmart, a lot of those products never get to the front room. They never get put on the shelves. A lot of times you go out there, the shelves are empty. It's a, you know, it, they're so big, they're so powerful, they actually no longer have to be efficient. They're so big, so powerful, they don't really have to provide lower prices. They'll do a certain loss leader to advertise the fact that they do lower prices in certain areas, but then the rest of their products will be higher prices.
Why wouldn't they fill their shelves? Isn't that how you do business?
You know,
you
it's
mean
like,
you're just saying that they don't have the best people working for them?
I mean, it really is becoming like a, in many parts of this country, it's becoming like a Soviet-style system in which people just don't care. They don't need to get it out. You know, you're captive to them. You're going to come there anyway. The idea that this is an efficient system is really, it's bunk.
What did the Dr. Miles Supreme Court case decide about pricing?
Dr. Miles decided that pricing could be, this is a 1911. One of the big debates in this country is who gets to set a price for a product. Like, say, if I make a salt shaker, if I'm in a real marketplace and say you're buying my salt shaker, then I ultimately get to determine what the price is. Now, you might not like my price and you might go away, but it's up to me to determine what the price is. Dr. Miles was a decision in 1911 that basically said that the intermediaries, the trading companies that stand between you and me, if we're in different cities, that they could set the price. And that law was essentially overturned in a variety of ways in 1919 by the Supreme Court, and then it was overturned by by Congress in the 1930s, because they said this producer has to have the right to set the price. And what happened in 1975 is that law, the Congress gave Walmart, gave the intermediary companies, the trading companies, the power to set the price.
But as a consumer, I would see it differently. I remember when a price was set by the manufacturer and everybody had to sell at that price. That meant, for example, that wines all were sold at one specific price. There was no competition. When things changed, we saw prices come down in some stores. Usually it was to the advantage of the bigger store because they could buy in larger quantities. But as a consumer, I appreciated that.
Well, there's this period. It's like for a while. I mean, this change in law, what it promoted was rapid consolidation among the producers of, say, salt shakers. Back in the old days, if I had a salt shaker and I was charging you too much and insisting on too high a price, someone else would come in and sell another salt shaker, and all the different retailers out there would say, "Okay, we're going to provide our customers with this lower price, better quality salt shaker because this other guy's ripping our customers off." What's happened since then is you've had massive consolidation among the salt shaker makers, for instance. So you end up, like with Luxottica, you end up with one company controlling all the eyeglasses, one company controlling all of the milk. So you end up in a situation in which we don't even know what prices are. It's all arbitrary.
Now, we've been talking about Walmart and Target, but in New York we're seeing only a continuing a smaller number of drug outlets, a listener points out, in the major retail field. Federated Stores seems to now pretty much own all the major department stores.
Yeah, and it's important. I mean, we have to understand that it's not just a matter of how this affects us as consumers. And what I point out in Cornered is that as consumers, this is not serving us anymore. There is maybe a period of time when this consolidation helped us out a little bit. But we also have to understand that we are citizens and we are producers. We produce work. We produce ideas for better types of retail, for better types of restaurants. Now, in New York, there's a lot of space for that better type of retail, better type of restaurant. In the rest of the country, it's just not that way anymore. So if I have a better idea, it used to be that my laws protected my right to bring my idea, my work, to the marketplace where my fellow citizens could choose it or not. Now I no longer have the right to bring my ideas, my work, to free and open marketplaces. Those marketplaces in this country, they're owned by a few people using large corporations to determine who buys what, who does what the price is, and who gets all of the profit.
Has this led to the high cost of health care?
It certainly is a factor in certain elements in the healthcare system. For instance, with a lot of the medical devices that we buy, if you want to go buy, you know, for instance, syringes, medical syringes, one company, Becton Dickinson, 90%, by some estimates, 90% of the marketplace for syringes controlled by one company. They've had that for essentially 40 years. And they use that power to raise prices. They use that power to put inferior product onto the market.
We have very little time, but a lot of listeners are wondering what can be done. Has anybody in Congress proposed new anti-monopoly laws, antitrust laws?
The Obama administration is looking with a lot of energy into what's going on in agriculture. There's been a radical consolidation of power over the people who farm our meat, who farm our chickens, who farm our hogs. They're looking at that. That's a good start. Other than that, though, zero. There's nothing out there. But it's very important for us to understand that we can beat these guys again. We did it in the 1930s. We did it in when we founded this country. You know, the real Tea Party was a rebellion not against high taxes. It was a rebellion against monopolization of commerce by one company called the British East India Company.
I suspect you're not going to get the Tea Partiers to join you in this campaign.
I actually talked to a lot of Tea Partiers, and actually a lot of them are ready to fight the large corporations. They're not as they're not only anti-government, they're anti-corporation, and they understand that the pathway to smaller government is to take down the large private corporations, which are private government.
Barry C. Lynn's book, Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction, is published by Wiley. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.